The intersection of endurance sport, health, fitness and life. Challenging conventional ideas and empowering people with the science of self-propelled motion. This is the Endurance Experience Podcast, hosted by Tony Rich.
This is a podcast that will be particularly helpful to the endurance enthusiast part of our listener base, from recreational to professional, as well as those that have a general curiosity about nutrition and fueling, either for endurance sports or just if you're a part of the general fitness community and you have some curiosities about nutrition and fueling for athletes. I've been looking forward to this podcast mainly because it gives us a chance to do a little bit of myth busting, but also tap into some of the nutrition science. There's a great deal of confusion and debate about nutrition and race nutrition, what to do, when to do it, and so on. And so this podcast will be one that I hope will be a little nugget that we can always come back to and maybe even do a part two follow-up, because there's endless topics here that you can go on and on. So let's see. There's the latest trends in the endurance sport world in this space. There's the latest fad diet. That's all the rage. That's nothing new. I mean, we've seen that in general fitness, but it also exists in endurance sport nutrition. Then there is the supplement craze, and those that know me know I have a certain level of derision for the supplement industry. But that's another topic. There's the quote-unquote natural movement, or the idea that because something is quote-unquote natural, it is ipso facto better. Then there is the so-called superstarches that are supposed to be orders of magnitude better than traditional race nutrition. It has better fat oxidation and lipolysis and so on. Releases carbs slowly, etc. So there's a lot of extraordinary claims there. Then there's a host of debates that I simply refer to as timing positions, right? So that is the optimal time to take in a particular nutrient, either post-workout or during, which I think is more of a genuine argument when you look at some of the science and positions. And then there's implementation debates, like the one about separating hydration and fueling, and these really are just scratching the surface. Of course, you see some of these back and forths on social media and comment sections, which can be horrifying to coaches that are using evidence-based approaches. So many of these positions you'll see ultimately appear to make the issue more complicated than they need to be. There's a problem-solving principle embraced by everyone from mathematicians to NASA engineers called Occam's Razor. Some of you may have heard of it. It's a principle that simply states that all else being held constant, the simplest solution, or the solution rather, that makes the fewest assumptions tends to be the most optimal choice. And in my opinion, I think what we tend to see is people attempting to solve a simple question, more simple question, and they're trying to solve it cleverly, more with more complicated ideas, and they're rendering the issue more complex than it needs to be. And it certainly doesn't help that many of the positions about nutrition rival those debates in religion and politics, and people seem to confuse what's actually true with what they want to be true, and those are two entirely different things. And so I'm over 18 years now down training and racing and literally traversing the distance of the planet Earth a couple times over with the amount of training and racing that I've done, and actually traveling through the wormhole and experiencing the effects of nutrition and race nutrition in years of training cycles. And that certainly gives you a certain level of hands-on experience versus just simply reading it from a book and trying to apply it or doing the Google searches and such. And so having now, you know, progressed with that experience now as a coach of athletes and a sports nutritionist and building out a platform where we're trying to systematically train, coach, and transform bodies for competition, I've seen all sides of this. And what I would offer to coached athletes, it's the same thing that we offer to our coached athletes and even mentoring younger coaches. What I would offer is you simply must have to have an evidence-based approach and always come back to the question of what does the science say? And you have to be skeptical and get real experienced and qualified people involved to help you. Especially nowadays where out on, you know, social media platforms and such, everyone is a so-called expert. So with that being said, my guest today is one of the researchers I found early on that really helped me and was an inspiration to me. His research really helped me focus on what was important, but also helped inoculate me from what wasn't, both as an athlete and as a coach. So today we'll be speaking with Professor Oscar Uykendroep. He holds a professorship at Loughborough University and is the director of My Sports Science Performance Consulting and co-founder and co-CEO of Core Nutrition. I'll put the links to those in the show notes. He previously also headed up the Gatorade Sports and Science Institute. So all of the science that's baked into, you know, Gatorade's endurance products surely has his stamp on it, and surely others that he's worked with. And he's amassed accomplishments in endurance sports himself. A pretty good cyclist and triathlete and runner. He's counseled countless elite endurance athletes, current and former world record holders such as Haile Gebrselassie, Andreas Rehlert, and Chrissy Wellington. Using a scientific and evidence-based approach and philosophy to counsel coaches on matters of endurance sports performance, In his academic career, he's published over 250 papers and book chapters and published 8 books. He literally wrote the book on sports nutrition. And his book, Sports Nutrition, is often cited and referenced by coaches and sports scientists. I'll put the link to it in the show notes. And he's often tapped to speak on research topics, including the metabolic responses to exercise, the regulation of carbohydrate and fat metabolism during exercise, adaptations to training, and the influence of nutrition on metabolism. So I have a conversation with Professor Eugen Droop on many of the things that I just talked about in my intro, everything from general nutrition to what do you do 10 weeks out, what do you do 10 days out, what do you do in the 48 to 72 hour window to the event, going all the way to the start line, and actually during the race. And then we do a little bit of myth busting as well. So without further delay, I will give you Professor Oscar Eugen Droop. Professor Oscar Eugen Droop, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So just for our listeners, can you explain your education, your background as an applied scientist, and how this shapes your evidence-based approach and philosophy with training endurance athletes?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I got interested in sports science because I was interested in sport, and the endurance sports were my sports, mostly cycling, a little bit triathlon at the time. So this is before I went to university, and I decided to go to university and study exercise physiology, because I was so interested in sport and I wanted to know how the human body works and how you can sort of use that to improve performance. So it's I definitely went to university trying to find some of the answers for myself.
Right.
I spent some years at university at Maastricht University in the Netherlands. I stayed at that university, did a PhD. And in the PhD, it was in a department where they had a very strong nutrition background. And so I started to combine the exercise physiology with the nutrition. Later that became sort of the sports nutrition. I met Professor Coyle from the University of Texas. He came over to the Netherlands to work with me. And then he said, why don't you come and join me in Texas? Which I did a few years later. Spent a year there, which at the time it was one of the top places to study sports nutrition. And then I accepted a post at Birmingham University in the UK, and I still live near Birmingham, even though I, for my work now, I travel all over the place. But I still have a house close to Birmingham. At that university, we did a lot of research into sort of exercise metabolism, the relationship between nutrition and performance, but also nutrition, exercise, and disease. So the other end of the spectrum. So on the one hand, working with elite athletes at the highest level, on the other hand, working with patients who could hardly get out of bed. And I think you can learn a lot of things from where like physiology goes wrong, and also where the physiology is pushed to real extremes. So I worked there for quite a long time. I was the head of the human performance lab, and we did many studies that, and the results of some of those studies have found its way into the advice that we give to athletes these days. After that, I wanted to do something completely different, and became the senior director of the Gatorade Sports Science Institute. And did that for a few years, like traveling a lot all over the world, like working with athletes, but also working on education programs, research programs. And then the last few years, my passion has always been to take the science and try and translate it into something that athletes can actually use. And I think there's a lot of great science being done all over the world, but sometimes what is lacking is the translation of that science into something practical. And not all of the science is accessible for people. It's difficult to read research papers, and I think even more difficult to interpret research papers, because the context in which they were performed, the studies, determines really what you can do with those results and whether you can actually do something with them.
Right.
Because research environments are very controlled, and usually a very specific type of athlete that people work with. So it's not easy to simply translate all of that to different athletes in different environments, and that's often what you have to do.
Right.
So that's what I do these days. I work as a performance consultant with a lot of teams, elite athletes, also organizations, to help people improve their performance. And usually there's a focus on nutrition, but not always.
Right. Okay. And that's very important. And I'm a analyst and data scientist by career trade, and I think it's important to have an evidence-based approach with so much out there that is difficult for athletes to absorb, and there's a lot of information and bad information out there, and it's hard to really differentiate what's good and what's bad. And so that evidence-based approach and philosophy is certainly very important. It's why for many years I've always looked at some of your research and publications to see if I can make sense of the latest research. Now, are you still racing?
Yes, I am still racing. So what I race, so triathlon or cycling or running, it depends a little bit on time, and sometimes it depends on what fun events are coming up for me. So I'm so busy with so much travel that sometimes I have to kind of choose my races to fit the work schedule.
Right, I know.
It's definitely reduced a little bit, but I'm still racing.
Yeah, I know what you mean about that. And when you become a coach, you have to make that decision on how much time you're going to spend racing, and you can't really be as competitive as you used to be. So I know exactly what you mean. I think I do races almost solely recreationally now. So you're the thought leadership behind MySportScience.com, and who are some of the elite athletes that you've worked with? You can do a little name dropping here.
I have to be a little bit. I don't like the name dropping, but I usually mention the same examples, because they are pretty cool examples, and right. They've really shaped the way I think about things. And one of those athletes was Haile Gebrselassie, and he is someone who ran 27 world records from 1500 meters all the way up to the marathon. Incredible athlete, and also an incredible person. And so working with him was very special for me, and I think I learned probably more from him than he's ever learned from me. Especially working in a country like Ethiopia, where they don't have an exercise lab, they hardly had an athletics track. They had one track at the time in the whole country. So very difficult to actually do any studies in that sort of environment. Mm-hmm. But we did, and so it's some cool experience. And then another athlete that I work with is Chrissy Wellington.
Right.
She's a four-time Ironman world champion. Never beaten in the Ironman distance, but she had some definitely some nutrition issues in the first long distance triathlons that she did, and so we worked together on that, and she describes this in her books a little bit.
Right.
And yeah, she I think she completely figured out what those problems were, and the last few races she did were without any problems.
Right. Great. Yeah, two phenomenal athletes at the time at their peak. It was inconceivable you'd ever see anybody faster than that. And then of course now we're seeing people faster faster. It's pretty amazing what we've seen in the sport. All right. So let's start right in with, you know, talking about nutrition. First, just general nutrition. Now, since I would say the last decades, I mean, we always hear about these diets, these fad diets that come along. It seems like a new one comes along every other year. Everything from South Beach to Paleo to Atkins. Now it's like ketogenic, which is like if Atkins and Paleo had a baby, it'd be ketogenic. And then there's all of these. Now I've looked at these diets, and from time to time I try to figure out whether or not there's research or efficacy. And I haven't really found that these diets do anything but really manipulate energy balance in a different way. So I wanted to get your ideas on that. Where you do you see that as I do, that these diets, all of them, are just unique ways of manipulating energy balance?
Yeah, I think you're pretty you're spot on there. I think all of these diets, let's start with this, all of these diets can actually work to lose weight. Any diet can work, because as soon as you start a diet, you're really paying attention to your diet, you're paying attention to what you eat, and you will lose weight. And this is also, you can find this in the literature, so you can find evidence that like a low-fat diet can reduce weight, a low-carbohydrate diet can reduce weight. There are really extreme ways to do it, and you will lose weight. The less extreme ways to do it, and you'll lose weight. You reduce carbohydrate and fat intake, you also lose weight. So, yes, it is really about making sure that you are in negative energy balance, and you do that by paying attention to what you eat.
Right.
And of course, it is possible that some people find it easier to reduce their intake on a certain diet. So that is possible. Or they like foods that fit into the category of a certain diet, and the diet sort of gives structure to their thinking. So it is possible, but I think an important message is that there really is nothing magical about these diets.
Right.
It is really about eating less and moving more.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. And I mean, and that's very important. It's a very important message, especially with athletes, endurance athletes, who are always seeking for the silver bullet. Like there's a silver bullet way of doing something, and it's just moving more, eating less. So let's talk about that. Now, when you're working with endurance athletes, and obviously you're working with a lot of elite of the elite athletes, and many of us coaches will work with people on the range of recreational. Maybe sometimes you might come across an elite athlete. So if you're working with elite athletes and some people on the recreational side, you know, you're just sort of trying to point them in the better in the direction of slightly better health and fitness. But what's your general philosophy on just general nutrition, and what's the approach that you look to convey to athletes as they're trying to maximize power to weight ratio. Maybe it's to progress towards a better competition body for a recreational athlete or an elite athlete.
I think my approach would be like a no nonsense approach, no magic approach, and real foods approach. And always taking into account what is important for that particular person, for that particular athlete. If you work with an elite athlete, it is about seconds sometimes. Sometimes it's about fractions of seconds. Every little bit of improvement can help. Is that really important for the age grouper whose main goal is to get to the finish line? So I would say no. So for that person, it's much more important that they can have fun on their day, that they have no gastrointestinal problems, and they feel great throughout the race.
Right.
It's not about sort of pushing to get the last bit of energy out of the body. And so it's understanding what is the goal of that athlete, and what are we really trying to achieve, and then you develop a strategy that matches that. And it's also when you're looking for the foods that will help the person achieve those goals, try to look for real foods when possible.
Right.
Sometimes it's actually challenging with real foods to do the things that we want to do, and that's where like sports nutrition products can be really useful.
Right.
But I think in a lot of cases you can just solve it with normal regular foods. I think the really important part is to understand it, what exactly are the goals. And to go back a little bit in our conversation, I think a lot of the confusion that we have in nutrition is that people generalize, and so we have certain diets that are aimed at people who are trying to lose weight, but those are people maybe that do not exercise at all.
Right.
And then we take that particular diet and we take the things that we want to hear about that diet and apply it in an exercise setting where maybe we are training 2-3 hours a day. And it may be totally inappropriate because you use a lot more fuel, you use very different fuels, and therefore the diet has to be drastically different. So a lot of the confusion is because we don't take into account why we're doing these diets.
Right.
So.
Yeah. And I echo the sentiments, you know, real foods, foods that humans have relied on for, hundreds of thousands of years, fruits, vegetables, you know, lean meats, legumes, right? And there's nothing fatty about that, or it's just, you know, you're focusing on simple, healthy foods, and, you know, trying to, if insofar as you're trying to get a little healthier on the recreational side, it makes sense to, you know, making sure that you're in caloric deficit when you need it.
Yeah.
And that's it. It's simple, right?
Yeah, so this is simple, but so people want it even simpler. They want to divide foods into two categories. One is good and the other category is bad.
Right.
And a lot of the diet books are written that way, and it usually villainizes a certain food or a certain nutrient. And that's what you have to avoid in the diet.
Right.
And that's the whole diet is about that. But it's not about avoiding things. It is about having certain things maybe in moderation and other things a little bit more on certain days when you need it.
Right.
So, but it's a lot of it is common sense, and but it is not black and white.
Right. Interesting. Okay. So I also wanted to ask you about the within the training cycle, you have athletes that are, you know, maybe they got a, you know, big race coming up and they're training hard, or maybe it's a recreational athlete that's just trying to finish. What do you make about the so-called critical post-workout window after hard training days? The evidence on this is sort of mixed, and I wanted to ask you about whether or not there's anything to this to this criticality in eating certain nutrients immediately after, you know, 30 minutes after a workout?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And this is, it goes back to what I started with, is that sometimes it's very difficult to take the science that's out there, the research that's been done, and then turn it into a practical message. And what the research does is they're usually looking at like acute recovery. Mm-hmm. So if you look at those studies, it's very often you exercise someone to exhaustion, they then rest for 4 hours, and then they exercise again. Okay, what can we do in that four-hour period to see if we can like optimize the performance 4 hours later? And there are certain things that we know will help.
Right.
But the question is, if you're a normal athlete, do you train, or do you train all out 4 hours later? Probably not. Right. Probably you're training the next day again, and maybe right. even a little bit easier the next day. So you have a lot more hours to recover. So can you really take the research findings that say this is what you have to eat if you want to recover in the 4 hours and apply that for the 24 hours? Mm-hmm. Maybe it doesn't do any harm, but maybe it is also not necessary. And I think that's probably the case. A lot of the studies are looking at sort of acute recovery within like 6 to 8 hour window.
Right.
When you look at a 24 hour window, a lot of the things are less critical.
Got it.
So if that acute recovery is really important, then also that window is relatively important, and you have to eat your carbohydrate, your protein probably in the hour after finishing your workout. If you have 24 hours, well, then I'm not sure it really makes a huge difference if you wait a little bit longer.
Right.
Yeah.
That makes sense. So oftentimes, especially triathletes, will do double sessions. We'll do a swim and a bike, or sometimes a marathoner. If they're in a build cycle or peak cycle, they might do a double session a morning and in the afternoon, or a morning and an evening, or something like that. And in that case, it seems like it might make more sense to immediately fuel and try to repair afterwards.
Yeah, it could make sense, but it also depends a little bit is what is the goal of that second session?
Right.
Because we also read a lot about training low, for example. And with training low, you actually deplete your muscle glycogen or your liver glycogen in the first workout. You then come back, you don't actually do all the recovery that you would normally do. So you avoid carbohydrate, or at least have very small amounts of carbohydrate, and you go out again in the afternoon. So the afternoon you train with low muscle glycogen, and studies show that you may actually get some benefits from that in terms of training adaptation.
Right.
So in that case, you probably don't want or don't need all of the acute recovery. So it really depends on what you want to achieve. If it is really important that the second workout is really high quality, and if it's, for example, swimming and technique is really important, then you don't want to start that session really tired. Mm-hmm. So maybe in that case, I would really optimize the acute recovery. If I'm really in a building phase where I just want to be as good as possible in 10 weeks from now, I don't worry so much about the quality of that second session. I worry about where I will be in 10 weeks' time.
Right. Got it. Excellent. All right. Okay, let's go into some more fueling. And I think talking to athletes, it's the frequent conversation that we have about fueling that sometimes it gets into, you know, the specifics of the athlete, And, you know, sometimes there could be some, you know, general best practices. So I wanted to sort of look at a scenario with you where you had an athlete 10 days away from a long course event, where it was a half Ironman or marathon or Ironman. What are some, you know, knowing that there's some things that are going to be really specific to the athlete, what are some general protocols that coaches and athletes should look at when they're, say, 10 days out from an event, and you know, very specific to fueling?
Well, the first thing I would say to that athlete or that coach is, well done that you're actually starting to think about nutrition 10 days before, because very often athletes start to think about their nutrition plan the day before, when they're walking around and at the expo and they see all these exciting new products. So that's one of the most common problems. But I would also say, instead of 10 days, I would actually prefer to start 10 weeks before the event with my nutrition planning. Because if you start 10 days before, you can't really train your nutrition plan. Whereas if you start 10 weeks before, you have several opportunities still to train exactly the plan that you're going to use on race day. Mm-hmm. And I think that is actually critically important.
Right.
But if you're 10 days away, I mean, those 10 days, you don't have to do a lot of things differently. You just do your normal training, do your normal nutrition. I think where it becomes a little bit more important is when you get to 2 or 3 days before the event.
Right.
It's more important for those people who often have stomach problems, because if you have those problems, I would start to reduce fiber intake, maybe reduce dairy products the 2 to 3 days before the race, because studies do show that can have an impact on the gastrointestinal problems.
Right.
And then the most important day is really the day before. And the day before, you just want to make sure that your body carbohydrate stores are full. And you just do that by paying attention to carbohydrate. And the mistake that people often make there is that they go to a pasta party and they try to eat as much as possible. And that's not really what carbohydrate loading is. Carbohydrate loading is not overeating. It's something different. It's really like increasing carbohydrate intake, but actually making sure that the overall energy intake is not ridiculous.
Right.
So what you do is probably increase carbohydrate, probably reduce fat in intake, and protein doesn't have to be a huge amount either the day before.
Right. So that 72 hour window, I've heard values, and some of the values that we will use with athletes is 4.5 grams to 5 grams per pound of body weight per day.
I would say that's definitely on the low side.
More than that.
Yeah, I would definitely, but it also depends on how much training you still do. Mm-hmm. Some athletes still do a little bit of training the days before, so you expend a little bit of energy and probably use a little bit more carbohydrate. That needs to be replenished as well. But I would say in those days before, you if you're relatively inactive, I would push it to 7 grams per kilogram.
Yeah.
And if you're fairly active, I would push it even higher.
Interesting. And so when you work those numbers out for athletes and you show them that, and you give them an example of how much carbohydrate that is, oftentimes their eyes will get really big. They'll say, how can I get that much food into my body? But, you know, it's... you're not walking around on a daily basis trying to get that much carbohydrate in. So,
yeah. No. It's for a very specific purpose, right? And that's also, it's not definitely not my message that that's something you should do every day.
Right.
It's where we're now talking about, like, really optimizing everything for race day performance.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you get your carbohydrate in that 48-72 hour window. You go to sleep. Hopefully, you can get to sleep early without getting too much insomnia the night before, and then you wake up 4 a.m. say race morning. What's your general protocol then?
Yeah, so from the literature, we know that if you eat about 3 to 4 hours before a race, that 4 hours is sometimes impossible. So 3 hours, 2.5 hours is still a possibility usually. So that's when you have your sort of breakfast. And in that breakfast, studies actually show 400 grams is sort of optimal. Mm-hmm. That is really not a very practical amount, especially not on race day when you're nervous. So this is another situation where this is something you can do in a laboratory situation, but in the real world is actually very difficult to do.
Right.
But I think the most important goal of that breakfast is to make sure that you fill up your liver glycogen. So the day before with your meals, you fill up your muscle glycogen. And if you're not exercising, that will stay high. But when you wake up in the morning, your liver glycogen is pretty low. So you need at least 100 grams of carbohydrate to make sure that you top that up again. And a little bit more is probably safer. And any excess is probably stored as muscle glycogen, so a little bonus. So I would still push it not to 400, but somewhere between 100 and 200 grams of carbohydrate the morning before.
Now, does it matter if it's liquid or solid carbohydrate?
No, not at all.
Right.
I think this really comes down to personal preference, and especially on race morning when people are nervous, is sometimes really difficult to eat.
Right.
So for those people, liquid is could be a solution. And other people just like to have some solid food with a coffee or something. And this is where, like, personal preferences actually play a really big role.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I've always used liquid just because, easier on the system, it leaves the system easier, things like that. But yeah, personal preference.
Yeah. I would say it doesn't really matter what you do, as long as you follow a routine that you know works for you.
Awesome. Okay. All right. So, going to the starting line and starting the race, fueling actually during the race. And so a lot of the science we've relied on for decades has been this quote-unquote salt and sugar approach and simple carbohydrate and sodium. And, that has driven race nutrition formulas from the big manufacturers in the forms of gels and blocks. Is this still the best approach, in your opinion?
Yeah, I think the main fuel is going to be carbohydrate. Mm-hmm. That's the performance fuel. So you have to deliver that in some way, and the way that's easiest really for the body to absorb, if you already deliver it in a way that it's just absorbed very quickly. Now, that can be done in different ways. So it can be done in simple sugars, mm-hmm. which the disadvantage of that is that usually whatever you're taking is super sweet.
Right.
But you could also look for certain starches. They're less sweet. Maltodextrins, they're less sweet. So there's different solutions. And a lot depends also on the pace. If you're an elite athlete and you're really pushing the pace really from the start, you want something that is absorbed really quickly. If you're, let's say, a 15-hour Ironman athlete, then you're going to be out there for a very long time, and just stomach comfort is much more important than delivering these nutrients very rapidly. Mm-hmm. So it really depends on the person what is best.
And so there's glucose, maltodextrin, fructose, sucrose. Is there any combination of those that maximizes the absorption of the carbohydrate that you're going to need if, say, if you know someone's going to be competitive?
Yeah, this I mean, this is research that we've done at Birmingham, where it became clear that if you take one single type of carbohydrate, it doesn't matter what type of carbohydrate, your body cannot use more than 60 grams per hour. That seems to be some physiological limit. And we figured out that it is caused by absorption. Mm-hmm. Your body cannot absorb more. And it is probably because there is a transporter for carbohydrates, for glucose, for example, that becomes saturated. Mm-hmm. And the only way that we found that you can get more carbohydrate into the body is by using a different transporter at the same time. And you can do that by a combination of glucose and fructose, or combination of maltodextrin and fructose. And that uses those two transport systems. Mm-hmm. With that, the absorption is like almost unlimited. We haven't really seen it level off. Mm-hmm. It's limited by the practicalities of it, of how much you can take. But if you practice this, I would say try 90 grams of carbohydrate per hour, very large amount, where 60 grams should be glucose or maltodextrin and 30 grams should be fructose. That seems to be a pretty good mix. And actually, a lot of the sort of formulations now, I mean, this research was done in 2004, but now, especially the last few years, I see a lot of like manufacturers use that sort of combination of carbohydrates.
Right, right. So it's already out there on the race courses, your endurance formula, Gatorades, and your blocks and your gels and all of that. Have some of those combinations. So, interesting. So, is there anything to the so-called superstarches, so-called slow release of carbohydrates?
No, I would actually stay away from slow release, because usually what that means is it is very poorly absorbed. Mm-hmm. So it is absorbed later at some point. Well, I don't think that's what you want in a race. You don't want to carry carbohydrate in your stomach or in your intestine. You want it to be absorbed and used. And then if you don't want to deliver it as quickly, then I would store it in my bottle, but not in my intestine.
Right.
So I don't understand this whole idea of slow release carbohydrates. It's all about delivering it fast, and if you don't want to deliver it fast, well, then don't drink it that fast.
Exactly. They haven't done the science on any of them. Really, haven't been impressive. So,
no, I think that, I mean, some of the starches, there could be an advantage, but that's mostly in terms of taste,
right?
Right, because it doesn't taste as sweet. That's where I could see an advantage over like a pure glucose solution that is like really, really sweet.
Well, perhaps someone might have medical conditions where they have adverse reactions to sugar in general. There's various issues and problems that someone might have where they just have to stay away from sugar, but maybe that's a viable option for them. So there's that, and what you're saying is very important, because I talk to athletes all the time that will try the I need to be natural and do it myself, mix it myself. I'm going to get honey from a beehive, and I'm going to suck maple syrup from a tree because it's natural and things. And my response is, look, you're not going to make that mixture better than a scientist, a manufacturer that has scientists that make those mixtures that you just described. You're not going to do that better than them. So
no, probably not. And I mean, the intestine probably wouldn't be able to tell the difference. But right. On the other hand, I would say there's not much wrong with something like honey because it has glucose and fructose.
Yeah.
And if that's what you like, it's a good way to do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you feel better with a sort of a natural product, well, why not?
Right. Yeah. The question is, can you, if you, you know, you have a system where you're trying to introduce complexity, that takes time.
And yeah.
It takes more thought to try to get the combinations right, to store it. Right.
Yeah, so. Yeah, and then you don't get the guarantees. You don't know exactly how much is in the products, and usually, if you have a formulation, then you know exactly what you're getting. That's very true.
Right. Okay. A few more questions. So there's been some discussion about separating out hydration and fueling, and is there any evidence on this either way? So what I mean is, there are some people suggesting that maybe you should just do water and then do your gels and blocks separately versus doing the sports drink, which combines hydration and nutrition.
Yeah, I would say that really depends whether you want to mix stuff in a bottle or stuff in a stomach. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. You need fluid, you need carbohydrate. It's going to be mixed one way or another.
Right.
And I think this is also partly because the research has been done in isolation. The research has been done on hydration, trying to find what is the best formulation for hydration. And the only outcome measure in those studies was hydration.
Right.
And other studies, including some of the studies that we did, we were looking at carbohydrate delivery. We didn't, in all of the studies, look at sort of fluid delivery, but we just optimized carbohydrate delivery. But the reality of a race is, of course, you need both. And I think I feel that actually, if you take the guidelines from like how much fluid you need, and you take the guidelines of how to best deliver the carbohydrates that you need, you can really combine those two.
Right. Right.
So, like a very simple example, if I calculate that I need, say, 1 liter of fluid per hour, that's quite a large amount, but and I want to deliver 60 grams of carbohydrate per hour, well, that means I have a 6% carbohydrate solution, and then I can deliver that in different ways. I can have a sports drink that is 6%, or I can have a gel. Or two gels and a liter of water, and it gives me exactly the same. Or maybe I use solid foods and combine that with water.
Right.
So we developed a little bit of software to help people do this. I don't know if you've seen this, but it's on fuelthecore.com. And there's a free version that people can try.
Nice.
So essentially, you go to the website, you say, I want to run a marathon, for example, and I want a nutrition plan for this marathon. You enter some information about yourself as an athlete, because to give a good nutrition plan, we need to understand, is this an elite athlete? Is this someone who runs a 4-hour or 5-hour marathon? Then we need to understand the conditions. If you pre-select an event that we've programmed, then it will automatically download the best prediction of the weather.
Right.
For that particular race. You also then are asked, like, what are the products that you want to use? Do you just want to use the products that are on course because that's convenient, or do you have a certain products that you really like, mm-hmm. or use your own natural foods, or whatever it is that you want to use. You tell the software what your preference is. Do you want water and then something else, or do you prefer thing, your fluids in the form of a sports drink. And then, so you've given the preferences and all the information that is needed to calculate your nutrition plan. You press the button and it tells you exactly what to take when.
That is very interesting. So, yeah, it sounds like, because I built a little spreadsheet model trying to do something very similar. What was that website again?
It's fuelthecore.com.
Okay, we'll definitely check that out, because that's important and one of the things that we try to do leading up to, say 6-8 weeks field test to try to get an idea of. You look at how much someone's burning per hour, how much hydration they lose per hour, and then if you know that.
Yes, all of this, it's all based on sort of the evidence that's out there.
Right.
So the software sort of calculates what are your carbohydrate needs. It corrects it for, one of the questions is, do you often have GI problems? If you do, it will correct those numbers so that when you use this plan, you're not going to have any GI problems. It's just safe and solid.
Interesting. All right. We'll put the link to that in the show notes so everyone can get it.
Mm-hmm.
So someone is armed with that information from the website. And what do you tell athletes on the when and how? For instance, there's this idea that if you're drinking, you should drink to thirst. But then there's other ideas that you should drink on a schedule, say every 15 minutes or 20 minutes, or eat on a schedule. So what's your thoughts on the when and how?
Yeah, I think for any sort of serious athlete, I just wouldn't go into a race just relying on thirst and hoping that when I'm thirsty, there's actually a drink available.
Right.
I would go in with a plan, and my plan would be based on how much I sweat. And my plan would be based on how much fluid I find acceptable to lose at the finish line. Because I don't need to finish with the same weight that I started. It's fine to lose some weight and it's fine to lose some fluid. But you don't want to lose too much.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then the software I was talking about takes that into account.
Got it.
If you take that into account, you can have a drinking plan that is actually pretty accurate. And it's very simple to measure your sweat rate. Just measure your body weight before training, measure your body weight after training.
Mm-hmm.
The difference is mostly sweat. If you had something to drink, you need to correct for that, of course.
Right.
If you had a stop on the way, then maybe you have to correct for that as well. But generally, this is a very simple calculation that you can do. And there's another little bit of software that will come out very soon, and that helps you to calculate your sweat rate and even predict your sweat rate. So if you do a number of measurements in different conditions, and now you're going to Hawaii Ironman, for example, you can plug in the conditions of that race, and it will, based on the measurements that are already in the system, it will come up with a estimation of how much you're going to sweat in that race.
Fascinating. Yeah. Now, what about the male versus female? Does it take that into consideration? There's been some recent books, publications, and folks talking about the differences between men and women and then nutrition and race nutrition aspects that need to be taken into consideration. What about that at all?
Yeah, I think if you measure your sweat rate, it doesn't matter whether you're a man or a woman. Sweat mm-hmm. rate is measured. It's
right.
Your sweat rate. And in terms of carbohydrate needs, we've done studies directly comparing men and women, and we cannot see any differences in absorption, in the capacity of the intestine to absorb carbohydrate. And absorption is the limiting factor. So I haven't seen any reasons why women should not follow the same guidelines.
Right. Fascinating.
But of course, we do have much less research in women than we have in men. But so far, I haven't seen anything to say like, look, we need like very different guidelines for women.
Right. Got it. And some, like you said, that's going to be factored into the, you know, per pound of body weight.
Yeah.
It's going to be factored in the sweat rate, factored into how much you expend per hour. That's going to be factored in there.
And I think the other factor is maybe how much carbohydrate you take in your diet. And female athletes usually have a slightly lower energy intake, slightly lower carbohydrate intake, and maybe that needs to be factored in a little bit. But that's what the software I was talking about already does. So it does it for men and for women.
right. All right. Great. So a couple of final questions. Any other words of wisdom about just race fueling? Those are the questions that are always asked of me of this topic.
Yeah. Well, I think the most important point is plan your race nutrition well in advance. Like I was talking 10 weeks. That's probably like a pretty good time frame. And then practice that race nutrition strategy. And I still know very few athletes who actually do this really seriously. They follow all the workouts that they're supposed to do to the minute. Everything is very detailed, the exact powers, the exact heart rates. But in terms of nutrition, they just do something.
Right.
On most training days, so I would make one day a week really a day where I would practice my race nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's a Saturday when it's the longest ride or the longest workout.
Right.
And then on that day, just practice what you're going to do on race day, or maybe even take a little bit more than you would do on race day.
Right, and this is very important. And I was as an early athlete, I was definitely guilty of this. And you mentioned beyond 10 weeks, you know, going back, just practicing, training your gut. Just like you need to train your body, you need to train your gut. And instead of that, oftentimes athletes will just wait until race week and then just start sucking in all this carbohydrate, and then they get gastrointestinal issues and such. So that makes sense, training your gut just like you're training your body. All right, couple final questions. What do you think is going to be the future, the next generation of either nutrition or race nutrition? There's some research, preliminary research coming out about personalized nutrition for certain genotypes. What do you think is going on there?
I believe very strongly in personalized nutrition, but not in that way.
Mm-hmm.
I believe in it the way we discussed it. You personalize it based on your sort of physiology, your performance level, your preferences also.
Mm-hmm.
And that way you personalize your nutrition strategy. But there are all these like genomic tests that you can do. They're getting cheaper as well, and you can test your genes and you get a report, and the report tells you that you're more likely to need this or that. I think we are very far away from that being anywhere near useful, especially for athletes.
Right.
I think we have far too little research when it comes to health outcomes,
right?
But we're starting to use it there as well. But we have far, far, far less information about exercise performance in relation to genes and nutrition, and so really, we're not basing our decisions on much at all,
right?
So I think the most important factors are really how fast are you going to go, how much carbohydrate do you need, how much are you going to sweat, like the factors that we talked about today, right. Those are the important factors to personalize your nutrition on, not the fact that maybe you burn a little bit more fat because of a gene. I don't think that is going to affect the your nutrition plan very much at all.
Right. Interesting. Perfect. All right. Well, it was definitely great and a pleasure talking to you. We want to be sensitive to your time here. Where could athletes find you on social media and any other publications or books that you got coming out soon? You're welcome to plug those.
Yeah. Well, the first place I would send people to is the is my website, and it's more of a hobby really, because I wanna make sure and share sort of the science that is out there, and also I talk a little bit about the non science that's out there.
Right.
So I try to separate the sort of the myths from like what the studies actually say on mysportscience.com. Mm-hmm. So that's the website, and then people want to follow me on Twitter or Facebook, then it's just my last name. It's JeuKenDrup. That's where you can follow me. And then if people want a race plan, then I would go to that website that we talked about, fuelthecore.com. We're still developing it, and we're still looking for feedback. So anything that people their experience they want to share using the software, please let us know. And finally, I guess I just had a book come out a few months ago. It's a sports nutrition textbook, maybe not for everyone. It's quite a heavy book, like a doorstop. For people who are really keen to read more, especially about sort of the background and the biochemistry and the physiology, I would refer them to that textbook of sports nutrition.
Yeah, I will definitely get it, even as a reference. I've been watching a lot of what you do for many, many years, and I'll definitely put the link to fuelthecore.com in the show notes so people can go there. So, Asker Eukendrup, thanks for coming on to the podcast.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's fun.
Thanks to Professor Eukendrup for coming on to the podcast. I really enjoyed that conversation. I felt we could go on and on there. So, just a quick follow-up so that we don't confuse folks. So, Professor Eukendrup is using a metric in his numbers that he gave. So I just checked his website just to make sure. So general fueling for carbohydrate, he gave 5 to 7 grams of carbohydrate per kilogram of body weight per day. Carbohydrate loading in the 36 to 48 hour window, 10 to 12 grams per kilogram of body weight per day in that window. So, for those of you who are in the States, those are the per pound of body weight were the numbers that I gave. So, that works out to be 4 to 5 grams of carbohydrate per pound. Same numbers. I did the math, and it works out to be effectively the same amount of carbohydrate in pounds versus kilograms. So, that was the difference there in our conversation. So, I hope you enjoyed that, and each one of the topics we discussed could be its own podcast, and so we'll definitely try to have some more deep dives on some of these topics. The thing that we didn't get to was supplements, and I've actually heard him speak on supplements, but just to give some of my own thoughts here. And I think it's important for our listeners. I'm increasingly skeptical of supplements because of several reasons. First, realize that if you're eating healthy and you're eating well, nutrient-dense foods, fruits, vegetables, legumes, right? So lean meats, seafood, insofar as that you eat meats, you know, nuts and seeds, you know, nutrient-dense foods. Very infrequently will people require some supplement. If you do, and you're one of those few people you think you are, that's when you get a doctor involved and go to talk to your physician about that and see if you can work at that angle. The same thing with athletes, though. There are very small percentage of people that may require some supplement. And then there's some, you know, research that some of them could be used if you've done them, if you take part of them strategically. But even still, it's I don't get the sense that it's worth it to wade in those waters because of the unproven claims. You have an unregulated industry. They're not regulated. And so because of that, they will, you know, increasingly try to lure people down the pathway of a silver bullet fix that's going to solve all your problems. And I'm just simply against anything that's not regulated and does that. It's an unregulated industry, they sometimes contain substances that are either unknown or not safe. And because of that, you will sometimes have drug-to-drug interactions. That means, you know, there could be some supplements that conflict with your doctor's prescribed medications, and that could lead to adverse effects and such. So that's why you want to be skeptical of supplements. And, you know, the idea that something is natural, therefore it's safer and better, the more you take of some vitamin is better, and typically they don't really have any impact aside from making your urine darker and more expensive, because a lot of times it will just simply come out in urine, or worse, you can, you know, build up these toxic levels of certain micronutrients, which could be, you know, problematic, because the doses are the same regardless of your size, whether it's a 125-pound person, whether it's 225-pound person, the doses are often the same. So, again, you can just never go wrong with eating healthy, eating well, and focusing on whole foods, nutrient-dense foods that humans have relied on for millennia, and that's And that's where you put your all of your energy there. And then for athletes, there could be a small percentage of them that could help you here and there, but it's not really worth it, in my opinion, to have to wade through these waters. So that's with that. Now, after listening to the entire podcast, guaranteed there will be a certain percentage of listener that will make an argument, and the argument will go something like the following. I know with 100% certainty that XYZ diet or supplement or superstarch or whatever it is works. How do I know it works? Because I know for a fact it works. It worked for me because I did it, and I had the fastest time that I've ever had in XYZ race, and so-and-so said that this works, and they are the fastest, and so on and so forth. We hear that argument all the time. Here's the thing. Scientifically, you can't possibly say with 100% certainty that something worked, because you are an N of one. I mean, you remember from your statistics class, N equals one. And in order to determine that something works or doesn't work, you have to have a sample size of hundreds, sometimes even thousands of people in order to make a statement like something works and has efficacy beyond placebo
if something works with statistical significance. And so that's why you can't say that, and you can't really put your hang your shirt on what you think worked for you or what somebody else did for them and they say that works for them and so on. So let's have a discussion. Now, you can send all your comments in to contact@eventhorizon.tv. I'd also like to invite you to our Facebook group. Our Facebook group is Endurance Enthusiasts on Facebook. Just do a search for Endurance Enthusiasts and you'll find us there. We're happy to have a conversation. Anytime we post a podcast, we'll have a conversation there about the podcast, and then you can offer up your comments. Thanks for your time. This is the Endurance Experience.
Follow Event Horizon Endurance Sport on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter for training programs and services to become a member of our Endurance Institute or for a complete archive of podcasts, log on to our website, eventhorizon.tv.